A word to the wise. We are an explicit podcast tackling content with adult themes, as well as entering spoiler territory if you aren't caught up with us. This week's a short one. We're reading Part 7, Talons Through Preparation, in Professor Cold by Joe Abercrombie. Hey there, this is Cross.
I'm PJ.
And we are Words and Whiskey, a podcast for veteran and novice readers alike. We tackle fiction novels and love to talk about what we're drinking. You should think of us as your intoxicating weekly book club.
It's a morning episode, Crossland.
It is a rare morning episode, although maybe, I mean, rare in the overall oeuvre of the catalog, although more of those lately.
More of them lately because we have time in the mornings now.
It's true. We have so much time in the mornings. I definitely want to get into kind of talking about this whole thing, but it was funny to actually say the intro this time versus our last episode, which went immediately off the rails.
Yeah. So what fucks me up is the fact that the parts have names also. So like I got into the habit of the pattern of like the chapters and then the book title and then the author. But now it's the part and then the chapters, then the book title and the offer. And for whatever reason, that totally fucks my brain up.
PJ just can't do it.
I can't do it.
No, it's
I have
fine.
A bad
it's,
brain.
It's
I need to
it's
get
all
it
good.
Replaced. I don't know if it's still under warranty.
I don't think so. 30 years is a really excessive warranty, I think.
Lifetime
just about
warranties
anything.
Used to be more like... They used to be a thing. Not so much anymore.
So,
and even if they do exist, they are shells of what they used to be. But
it's very true. Very true.
I could go to the brain
store.
The point
of Micro Center.
Maybe I'm still under warranty.
Maybe. I don't think so, though. Check in with your mom. She'll help you out, I'm sure. That said, today is our 10th episode talking about Best of Cold by Joe Abercrombie. It is the part in which we start the final part of the novel. And I maybe just mean start.
it's a short one.
Yeah. It's three chapters, one pretty long chapter, and then two kind of like not so, not quite as one that's necessary, one that builds a big question in our minds before we kind of jump into the finale or kind of sets things up in a way. So, you know, part of the reason that I broke it up this way was because of the holidays, of which I believe this one is coming out the week of Christmas. So Merry Christmas if you celebrate. Happy holidays to whatever nation you are celebrating, whatever holiday you may be. But yeah, thanks for sticking out another holiday season with us.
Yeah, happy to celebrate. I'm sorry I haven't sent my Christmas cards yet. Haven't
oh
made
my
them.
God.
I haven't done one.
Exist.
I have a lot of jam. I could send out Christmas jam. Or like salsa?
Damn it. I thought I was going to escape. I was taking a drink and I almost spat it out. I swallowed it instead. PJ almost killed me. All right.
I think cool. That'd be a good holiday tradition to send out canned goods.
It sounds like so much work. And it would be so expensive.
Do you think the post office would care if I just wrote an address on a jar of jam and shoved
for sure
it in the mailbox?
Not when they throw those around, you know, like all those packages. Yeah, that'll go real well. It's just some poor man in the middle of Minnesota in one of the distribution centers, because you know it's not making it out of the state, is just sorting through a bunch of glass and raspberry jam.
It's strawberry, thank you.
Okay.
Actually, we do
is
have
raspberry,
strawberry, jam
raspberry
too.
Or grape. Yeah. Given what you have on your propote. Cool.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, sweet. Well,
yeah, but
through
to all you listeners, expect some jam or the remnants of jam jars in your mailbox soon.
What PJ is actually doing is he is just mailing fragments of glass individually stamped with little stains of jam on them. So don't worry about it. You're only going to get stabbed. Maybe.
This is usually reserved for the end of the episode.
Yeah, what's happening? PJ, go quick overview.
Quick overview for this week. Monza rides a horse, gives a speech and doesn't die. Casca lays siege to Fontezamo and sends brave men up a ladder to death. And Morvir becomes a carpenter.
Morvir may have always been a carpenter.
Maybe.
Yeah. Oh, man. There's so many things to say about this week, in particular with what we have, of course, to talk about. So I'm very excited to kind of get into it. But how'd you feel about this, you know, this brisk reading?
I am left with the desire for Morvir to build a bakery for Schenkt.
Hmm. Not the overlap that we expected. But we left Schenkt out of the quick overview.
Oh,
he's here too.
He's here. He doesn't.
So are Shivers and Friendly, but you know.
Yeah. He doesn't do anything.
Poke. Do something.
He's
literally
defined
this week by the fact that he doesn't do anything. Yeah.
Yeah. We'll get to him.
So the bakery. Building a bakery. Okay. Yeah. All right. Well, with that, we'll get into the meat of this here. We'll start with, of course, the what do you want to call it? The flashback of sorts that happens. That's basically right at the very beginning of the story, shortly before it begins, right? In which there's a name that's earned, but we'll talk about that a little bit more in a second. Again, part 7, Talons. And once again, the quote here that we read at the end of last week is, "Revenge is a dish best served cold," by Pierre Chollereau de Laclos or something like that. I don't know. I heard Pacey say it, and sometimes French things just sound mushy to me.
Yeah, and the guy has Chode in his name.
Which I think...
No! Damn it.
Have we gone this far off the rails and we didn't like take a shot? We didn't like. We barely started.
This is what you get when you get PJ without his glasses. That's what's up.
So, again, audio medium, so people are going to have a real tough time just differentiating that most of the time. He's like, all I see there is Chode in the middle of that there sentence.
It's an unfortunate thing to have in your name.
Yeah, very true. Okay, moving on. Since we have nothing clever to say about revenge being a dish best served cold, of course, great to have the callback to the title and the origin point. It seems natural, only natural considering nearly every book that Joe has done has been derived from some form of quote therein. So,
I'm pretty sure I brought this up last week, but because we read it right at the end of the episode last week, but I didn't realize that this was a quote that was attributed to anybody specific. So,
yeah.
It's kind of cool.
I mean, most things are, you know,
a lot of these like super ubiquitous terms. Yes, they had to have been coined by somebody, but they just kind of exist in the zeitgeist of culture.
Very true. Yeah. Right. I mean, I think I made very early on a joke because I was rewatching Kill Bill before this because there are also obvious inspirations there within this text, and I don't think it opens with it, but at some point very early on it has the same quote, but it doesn't attribute it to anyone. So yeah, it's interesting. Another like kind of interesting thing of note, I know that I like incidentally shit on the French a lot.
I do it on purpose.
Yeah, Rogan's really into that, so makes sense. Crap stain. But a lot of like aphorisms and other sort of like turns of phrase in language, a lot of them are French because the French were some of the earliest to like really kind of have the sort of late post printing press, like Renaissance and philosophical development. And so like there's a lot of like writing from the French. And so there's a lot of that just happened. In addition, the French Revolution, you know, had a ton of philosophers come forward and thought leaders and other things like that while they were chopping off heads and executing people all the time. So, yeah, couple of different things to note there, but
yeah, I had never really considered that sort of the late revolution, as it were, the late Renaissance being, and its alignment with the printing press being important to something like that. But totally,
yeah, makes sense. Printing press is what Martin Luther, which is 1500 something, but just like in general, sort of the writing coming to the fore and like language coming to the fore and being so important in society as they overthrew. Effectively, they were the first to overthrow a monarchy after the Americas, which was around the same time frame. So people always forget that the French Revolution is much, much closer in time frame.
I do. Constantly.
Yeah. Than a lot of people think, you know. Mm-hmm. Watching Napoleon gave me a fresh coat of paint on that, too, because I hadn't thought about it in a while. So.
Right. I've been meaning to go back and watch the director's cut of that.
Oh, it's so good. It's so much better. I didn't watch the original. I only watched the director's cut, but I went and I scrolled through because talking with a couple of friends, they were like, yeah, I just like, there seemed to be like not a whole lot of like sensical through lines to some things. And I was like, really? So much of it felt so clearly explained and like the relationship developed and like pasts explored. And they're like, yeah, no, like we didn't get any of that. And I was like, what? And then I just like did a quick scroll through and I was like, they cut out 20 minutes out of the beginning. There's so much shit there that's so good. That sets up Josephine so well that isn't in the movie at all otherwise. And I was like, what? Is anyway. It? Yeah, it was a wild turn. Highly recommend the director's cut for that reason.
Next time I find myself with like 5 hours, I'll do it.
It's only like three some odd.
That's what the standard edition is.
It's like 340 or something like that.
Okay.
It's not. Now you're having me double check. It wasn't that crazy. Yeah. Just shy, 48 additional minutes on top. So, and a lot of that's in the beginning and then interspersed, but cool. All right. So getting to the flashback itself, we have the butchering of Capriel that is basically happening here. It's depicted, I should say, throughout, but at first we don't know, but we know that this is the name that she carries, that she's won in the end, this sort of battle. And the nature of her attaining the name is entirely Benna's fault. And we'll get into kind of some of those specifics here. But we have the Baelish and the Thousand Swords that are incidentally unleashed on the city of Capriel as Benna fails to keep a tight leash on them over the morning as she was going with Orso and negotiating, in which Orso is also giving her like a crazy pat on the back for all the work that she's done and like really seems to be solidly in her corner.
And is similarly not out for blood for Capriel.
Like, not at all. Yeah.
Is this does not go Monza's way. It doesn't go Orso's way. They spin it, but it is totally counter to what she wants for the city. And also, once again, Bale comes into the spotlight of importance for the story.
Motherfuck, like, I just can't win on this one.
It's really
but yeah.
Fun. Oh, so good.
Yeah. It definitely does come into the fore, and I think that it's interesting to see them so prevalent, but also not make any kind of a lasting imprint, like I think I mentioned last week, clearly. even though they're really important to this event, right? Because it's the Baelish of whom are sort of depicted as, you know, northern adjacent, and they go into the city and begin pillaging, and then the Thousand Swords follow shortly thereafter.
Yeah. Her instructions to Benna was to keep the Baelish out.
Mm-hmm.
So them starting the siege sent some dominoes into the Thousand Swords too.
Mm-hmm.
Or not the siege, the pillaging.
Right. So we move, of course, from the sort of inciting incident here and the celebration that was to be had into the source of the failure. And we find Benna curled up in sort of a husk coma after she's addressed by the various members and captains of the Thousand Swords, each kind of saying it's, you know, in one way or another, it's not her fault. Especially, of course, great to have Carpi back for a moment and see him as sort of a reaffirming force like the old hound that he was in some ways. But she ends up choosing to own the mistake, despite it obviously being his fault. you know, it's kind of interesting because it is sort of her own mercy and cowardice turning her reputation sour. There's this little line here as she kind of owns up to the title of The Butcher of Caprile that she says, people would far rather believe a lurid lie than a sorry string of accidents. And so just the idea that this is painted in one way versus the reality of it being something completely different.
Yeah, and it frankly works out in her favor. This Butcher of Caprile moniker is used as an insult every once in a while for her, and I think she takes it as one as well. But for the most part, she's greeted with respect for it, or at least a brutal form of respect.
Yeah, I definitely understand where you're coming from. You're right that it is like decent within her profession, I would say, to have something like this, but not as though she didn't have it from all kinds of other things. And this is sort of,
true.
To me, this is more of like a stain, you know, on an otherwise, I wouldn't say spotless, because of course she's a general and a leader and a conqueror, but otherwise a pretty decent record as a commander.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it's a good point.
But yeah, I mean, to the other end, it does sort of earn her a rapscallion sort of reputation. It makes her more mercenary-like and less general-like, I think, in some ways, too.
Yeah, it gives her an air of ruthlessness even more than mm-hmm. what she already had.
Which is bitterly ironic because, like, again, she was the one that was like, we have to be, like, merciful and other things like that. And in all honesty, again, reflecting back on her own mercy and cowardice, she should have punished Benna a couple of times for the different things that he's done wrong, but she just can't bring herself to do it for, you know, one reason or another. That image of like her little brother that she's still protecting and insulating from the rest of the world, or, you know, her lover as well, that is mostly incompetent, but occasionally has flashes of, you know, I don't know, diabolical bullshit. Yeah, there's that whole I love you, I know thing right at the beginning, too, which is like tough.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That is tough. That kind of sucks.
Yeah. Yeah. But also, like, again, there's just this stain of incestual relationships that kind of goes over the top of this. That said, we get kind of the rest of this like little flashback is mostly a picture of the rest of the cities and how they react to the burning of Caprile and sort of the way that her reputation spreads. And I really love this idea that it's divided by the river, you know, kind of between, you know, which way people land on it. And the kind of final line here is, that was the difference between a hero and a villain, a soldier and a murderer, a victory and a crime, which side of a river you called home.
It's a great reflection, especially zooming out and looking at the larger powers and mm-hmm. the wars that they're waging and our sort of estimation of who our protagonists are in aiding those fights, specifically Baez and Kalul. Like right now, all of our protagonists are technically fighting for Kalul.
Right. Isn't that funny?
Mm-hmm.
It's a complete change from the last
totally.
Series. Yeah. Yeah, it is certainly interesting. And it does say, you know, often like there are so many sort of different pithy quotes that you could pull, but like history is written by the victors and like all of those sort of ideas that like, you know, the downtrodden are never written about with the same fervor, you know, as the victors. So I think that it just does point to kind of this sort of this never changing reality of humanity in which the conquered are subjugated and, you know, made to make their feelings feel inferior while the winners keep winning.
Yeah.
It's a heavy start. It's the last flashback, you know. So was there anything out of curiosity, was there anything else that you wish that you could have seen from Mons's past as a part of anything else?
Or? I'm sure I'll think of something, but it's not specifically. Like there's not a huge gap in my brain right now.
Totally. Was there any that was your particular favorite of the flashbacks that we had?
I think I'd still consider my favorite to be, I think it's the second one. where we see her
pick up the sword.
Yeah.
After farming.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
That's a good one. I really like the, personally, I feel like my favorite is the Sejan Koska one, that first introduction.
Mm, yeah.
Where, you know, she has to stand up and fight and knocks the dude down and everything else, and then brings her in, teaches her letters.
Is that the third one?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right before Sepani. Cool. All right. With that, we move into our first chapter here, Return of the Native. We open with a march into Talons, Monza being entirely comfortable, and later it's a great portrayal against, or being far from comfortable, and then Koska being entirely comfortable as they're going through the streets. But Monza's here, you know, march home with everyone kind of cheering her name, and it immediately reminds her of the previous victory that we just reflected on at the beginning, that of Sweet Pines. And almost like this was the march that she had earned forever ago, but is earned now in a completely different context.
Yeah, way different sort of demeanor that she has now compared mm-hmm. to then. But it is a remarkably similar scene.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
As intended, you know.
Right. I mean like, yeah, it's the whole point.
Yeah.
mm-hmm. But
yeah. I really just meant like this was the way that it was supposed to go in the end. But yeah, she's not comfortable with that for a dozen reasons. And yeah, demeanor, funny you mentioned, but obviously she's been scarred and battered, you know, her like gloved hand, her like crippled gloved hand in one case, her otherwise like torn up like leg and limp and everything else. So
yeah, I think it's around here. It's towards the beginning where she like points at something and she points with her ring finger and like, of course, her pinky goes along with it. Like,
yeah,
it was a totally unnecessary ad, but a very detailed accounting of how she's pointing at something from Joe.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I her prodding joke of a little finger seemed attached to a cord of cold pain, you know, and then like, again, it also reflects on like her scalp, you know, and sort of the, she doesn't specifically mention the like gold coins or anything like that, but obviously, you know, underneath is that layer. And then in addition, there's like that feeling around her neck where that wire was that like constantly itches
mm-hmm.
all the time. So she's worse for the wear than she once was when she was last in the city.
Right.
So there's reflection on her allies and the three men that she surrounded herself with feeling unreliable in her own life and then kind of friendly as a bonus, I think. Like, the three get deeper reflections and then friendly.
Yeah.
and the rest of the enemies that now follow behind her as her supporters, her ardents, as these, like, people that are the duchies that she had been deposing for Duke Orso over the prior years. It seems likely that she sees an end for herself here one way or another, as she kind of fears being maybe disposed of, if not by one of the three men that are closest, the league that's following close behind, even though this is also a march for her to be crowned. It's an interesting kind of paranoia that she finds herself in.
Yeah, she's teetering. Like, as she's, and I think we see it progress as well later on as mm-hmm. as the crowning happens, as things get more solidified, her steady footing gets less and less steady. But I do have to say, what would she reflect on Friendly? Like, Friendly has not really ever truly interacted with Monza in like really meaningful ways that we've seen. At least they've been together for a long time, but we've only really seen Friendly open up mostly to Koska, of course, but beyond that, shivers sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm with you. I don't think that she would have a more meaningful reflection, but mm-hmm. the fact that it's like is. Three meaningful reflections and then right. like and then Friendly's
here.
yeah. But like, the three people probably want her dead in some capacity, or like, you know, we know that each of them have their own vested interests. You know, Koska, we don't know. Rogan, we don't fully know. Shivers, we know that definitely wants her dead, you know. But yeah, that's kind yeah. of the immediate reflection, if that makes sense.
That's, yeah, it does.
Yeah. Speaking of, something that's really interesting here that pops up as a part of her walking through the streets and being flowered and showered with a bunch of things is that we see a variety of different posters printed everywhere that we had heard about previously from Rogan. So it's interesting. I really love the focus on the printing press and its utilization here. You know, another big part of Garibaldi's expedition that I, you know, haven't brought up in a while, but Garibaldi, again, being one of the people that was responsible for uniting Italy, reuniting Italy in the 1800s-ish post-Civil War, right?
Mm-hmm.
I need to double check my timeline, but by post-Civil War, I mean post-American Civil War. So anyway, very important, you know, very similarly used media and manipulation to kind of the same degree to blow out his reputation in a big way. Not that he himself necessarily did, but it was done on his behalf, which created this sort of larger than life picture. And in that same regard, we find Monza benefiting from it in sort of this reputational thing, even though it isn't necessarily something that she was doing so much as it was something that Rogan was doing on her behalf.
Yeah. And I think the fact that she wasn't doing it makes this so discordant for her, because while she's taking in these cheers and the support, all she's thinking about is the blood that she spilled and the atrocities that she's committed to lead her to this point. So she knows vaguely that Rogant has been spreading the word, but she has no idea what the messages actually were. So she has no idea how to confront it in her own mind.
Mm-hmm. Right. And she's just kind of stuck. I do want to correct myself a little bit here. It's right before the Civil War. It's 1860, but not after.
Good correction.
I mean, he was around after and continued to fight for the unification and other things like that. But like, anyway. Mm-hmm. Neither here nor there. But yeah, it is really weird. And she does have sort of, I like you saying, calling out that it's surreal, because I think that it becomes really clearly surreal when she sees that she's inspired vengeance as a single word, not spray painted, but painted across a wall, and how that makes her incredibly uncomfortable with like the what she's done or what she stands for versus what she wanted to be or potentially stand for, if anything at all. I don't think she was trying to stand for anything. No part of her says that she has some sort of moral compass that she's trying to put on others, you know, right. Like,
yeah, I get that the whole fucking point of the book, the title, the quote at the beginning of this part, the whole thesis of it is vengeance, but God damn it. Is it so interesting to see how much the inflection of that word changes over time through the story? I had a moment of like thinking about the movie and thinking about potential trailers for the movie and just a quick flash.
Oh, that's good.
Of every single time the word vengeance is said or shown would be really, really cool without like actually giving anything away.
Yeah, that would be interesting. And then you could see her standing there in front of like a wall, you know, painted with the word vengeance. And that would be such a striking image. I know you haven't seen it yet, and I won't spoil anything for people of whom, of course, will watch this. But there's a couple of different moments in Arcane Season 2 in which Jinx has inspired a rebellion of sorts. And there are a couple of different moments there that now, after you said that, my brain immediately clicked into place and I got shivers with some ideas of how you would like change that and reposition it for Monza. And yeah, to your point, the idea of vengeance and the way that it's done differently over and over and over again over the course of the story, and how the context shifts and changes and the value of that word, you know, both loses and gains different weights. You know, like at first there's this tone of like righteous retribution, and by the end here it's more of like a dull whimper and a sad thing to be chasing after. Ugh, good idea though, for real. Like that would be such a strong way to kind of end a trailer.
I think it could be the whole trailer, Crossland, but I'm always looking for trailers that don't actually give anything away. So you know.
Yeah. Well, agreed. Maybe that's agreed. Me. But maybe it's a teaser then, you know, to that point, like in the modern trailer parlance, because to be frank, I know that neither of us and a number of our friends, we avoid trailers as much as we possibly can for just about everything that we can. Sometimes we break. Sometimes we watch things. That's fine. It's not the end of the world. But often expectation can like demean, you know, and especially the way that trailers are built these days. But I want it. I would want a successful trailer for this. And I think that this would work really well as a teaser and then could work well to like close out a trailer. Because I think that that will do it justice. It's a necessary thing in marketing. So, you know, these days.
Yeah, fair.
Secret Level is pretty successful though right now. So my hope is that that leads to Tim Miller getting to do more of his shit. So people are loving it. Yeah. Oh, man, vengeance. Now, genuinely, PJ, I am just struck with like I have an image in my head that is so well wrought that I cannot wait to see brought to screen to some degree. There is an ultimate irony of sorts as she walks through the streets that now she's taking it as he had feared, you know, it is actually like taking away his dukedom and is being crowned, even though that was never something that she wanted explicitly, as we've seen many times over and over again. And we're back basically exactly where we started, riding through the city, but on such a different path.
Was this the same road that she and Benna rode in on?
No, that's the path up to Fontezarmo that we get okay. in the next chapter.
Gotcha.
But assumptively, they had to ride through the city. So, like, you know, they likely did.
You're right.
But she also comes to Talons right after she, you know, is pushed off the cliff, right? She's nursed back to health in Talons.
Yeah.
So,
by that guy who still hasn't shown back up, the bone thief.
Yeah, the bone thief. Yeah.
Where's yep. he at?
Where he at? He's where probably he at? In the crowd somewhere.
Probably.
He's probably just hanging out. He's like, hey, wait a minute. There's my, that was my project.
Do you think he, I don't think he drinks, he's got to be like a bone broth sipper, right?
Do you think?
I think he has to be.
I mean, bone broth's pretty good.
It's really good.
Yeah. Hadn't thought of that. Probably.
Or are his bones too valuable to turn into broth for himself?
Is bones too valuable?
They're mostly people bones too, so I don't know if people bone broth was.
Maybe he's an eater.
Oh, ooh, that'd be an interesting like spin on eaters. We know Shanks like cooks his food
bone. Yeah, yeah. You need them bones. Moving on from our bone thief, of whom, by the way, I don't think we brought up at all over the course of the rest of this book, since we had like a deep dive in that one chapter. I don't think we've ever talked about him ever again. But
yeah, maybe not.
I don't think so. Anyway, switching to Koska, funny that he reflects on politics and whether or not he should partake as he reflects on, I believe, the Duchess of Cepheline and her poisoning, of which I think is just really, really interesting, because we did get Morvir claiming last week that he killed the Duchess of Cepheline and poisoned her. So like that close interlocking.
Wasn't she Koska's lover? That got poisoned.
Yeah, but then she was also going to maybe turn on him, and he was going to poison her or something like that, which is what he's talking about here. But then she gets poisoned by
I'm just making sure it's the same person that he was talking about earlier when he like is first introduced to Morvir.
Yes. Yeah. Right. Yeah. So it seems like he's maybe tangentially aware. So like their anger and rivalry also it adds a layer to that.
Yeah. He knew it was
because he thinks the poisoners are scum. Right. Yeah. But then the ultimate, like, we know
it's him.
You know, dramatic irony that it was Morvir, provided all that he's saying is true, which is an interesting problem.
Right. Yeah. That's a big if.
Yeah. Big if indeed. But anyway, he also.
Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, he also reflects on like whether or not he can change and shuffling around that idea in his head as he takes a swig from his flask.
Yeah. I think it's a great parallel as far as partaking in politics versus partaking in drink. Because right around here, we also get the need for a drink, a drink sort of mantra in his head being dulled now compared to earlier where it seemed like it was screaming at him. Man, everything for me is still pointing to him being sober. Despite drinking out of the flask, which he has mentioned in the past that Like when he was on the rooftop with Monza, that like it's just a physical sort of tick or yeah. a way of stating the need.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. To that point, just to read that little quote that you practically hit, but a drink, of course, that drunkard's voice in his head would never be entirely silent, but it was less a desperate scream now than a grumpy murmur, and the cheering was very definitely helping to drown it out, mm-hmm. which is interesting.
Yeah.
To me,
this is all saying that he's not actually drinking.
Mm-hmm.
And it's getting a little bit easier to do that.
Yeah. There are a lot of lovely kind of exchanges that happen over these next couple of pages between Shivers, of whom is barely responding, and Koska, of whom, of course, is just kind of talking into the void and kind of proclaiming information as he reflects on the political situation, like we talked about, and how quickly people are to sort of change over time. But there's one that stands out more that I want to just bring up here. I've traveled widely, and in my experience, people are no heavier elsewhere. Men can have all manner of deeply held beliefs about the world in general that they find most inconvenient when called upon to apply to their own lives. Few people let morality get in the way of expediency, or even convenience. A man who truly believes in a thing beyond the point where it costs him is a rare and dangerous thing.
I feel like we get a pretty subtle but heavy dose of morality within this section. More than what we've gotten in the rest of the book.
And there's a lot of exploration of morality.
Yeah, we get more of it a little bit later too. But yeah, I think actually the next section mm-hmm. or the next point
from Shivers' perspective yeah. after Friendlies.
But in general, like morality is not a well explored or not a widely explored topic in this book.
I think the entire book is talking about morality, and I think that is sort of the whole point of this novel. So I think that it is well explored, but it's well hidden up until a point. And now we're pulling it all to the surface to make sure that we've interrogated the ideas, right?
Yeah.
Because that's Shivers' whole arc, right?
Yeah, that's a better way to put it.
Yeah. The book isn't lecturing morality. This part is exploring it a lot more verbally, whereas the book otherwise is a physical exploration of the ideas.
Okay.
But
yeah, good point.
Yeah. Vengeance and morality, I think, are two core components of this story. But yeah. Yeah. Cool. I mean, I really like that. A man who truly believes in a thing beyond the point where it costs him is a rare and dangerous thing. Like, you know, willing to lose and spend more of anything to get something else.
Yeah. Where's the danger come in? I guess from the point of view of somebody opposed to them or opposed to their, I don't know.
Beyond the point where it costs him is a rare and dangerous thing. So to me, what that reflects as is someone of whom is willing to risk more than just themselves to achieve a goal.
Or I understand. I thought it was going the other way in that it was not a, for whatever reason, I had it twisted in my mind. Like they're not directly benefiting from this.
Oh yeah. No, this is, it's the risk beyond mortality, beyond their own mortality. Right.
Right. That, yeah.
Similar to the earlier conversation that Shivers had about causes, right? Or actually, it was Koska, again, talking about causes. It's sort of the same idea reapplied that we talked about, I think, last week or the week before.
I think 2 weeks ago.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Hard to remember.
People empowered by causes together. Well, yeah. Technically speaking, we've recorded these three episodes in basically 7 days. So,
yeah.
8 days.
Less than that.
Something like that. Yeah. Yeah. A lot of BSC these days. But so, yeah, from there, we then switch to Shanked, watching from the crowd and very quietly humming to himself as he finally sees Monza from the side of the crowd. From Shanked, though, we see this as as something fully solidified. This throne in Talons is hers and hers alone. She's to come to power and here to be appointed its ruler, despite her reservations, perhaps.
He sees the writing on the wall and she hasn't officially been crowned, but the people are on her side. So they are so far on her side that if something goes wrong in the last minute, they'll still follow her.
Right.
And if she dies in the last minute, they'll avenge her, it seems. So
yeah,
he seems right in the fact that like this throne is hers.
I think there's also something here to say that they're fickle though too. Like, not
yeah.
She's definitely earned the throne in the moment, and I guess it's maybe more from Casca that the sort of fickle note comes through, that the people are fickle. Like, that is basically the quote that I read right before this.
I think it's still Shanked. Like right Shanked after still, this.
Yeah, because he does talk about the fact that there's like the tarnishing of political figures, right? Which is interesting because they find external validation in them, and like people in general find external validation in their political, you know, figures, and are like, we need to support them and prop them up, and then they fail, and it's like, ah man, now all we get to do is blame them for failing us. Like that change, that turn.
There's a small window of time where they can do no wrong, and fairly soon as people realize that their lives don't change, they can do no right. It's something to that effect.
Right.
I think that's still Shanked.
Yeah, that is still within Shanked. Yeah, he observes it as a tide, a golden period in which people are blinded by their own hopes for something better, basically, like you were saying.
Yeah.
Yeah. That said, Shanked has in this moment decided that he is going to see his work through, as he says, and he talks about holding out his hand to her, willing to step out in front of the crowd, but is just afraid of all of the onlookers around who might witness his work, as it were. But in addition, Shiloh Vitari has joined him here to help in some fashion, it seems. An interesting, you know, twist.
Yeah.
Maybe not a twist, but a surprise.
I think because we get some meditations on power and on political figures, but we don't really get a whole lot of action, and we don't really get a whole lot of action from Vitari at all, or much conversation for that matter.
Couple sentences, yeah.
So they mostly seem just like onlookers. So for that reason, I think this scene really reminded me of the execution. I think before they're hanged with Glockta and Artie in the crowd.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That is interesting, and it is pretty similar. In addition, Vitari says very little, like we said, but she, you know, what does she look like? A fucking gold candlestick, a gaudy figurehead gilded up to hide the rot. And that is, Vitari.
It's pretty good.
Pretty nasty. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Anything else on Shanked? This is all we see of him this week, so.
He was prepared. He was prepared to do it.
Mm-hmm.
It made me, I think last week when we learned that in very vague terms that Monza had become involved in his revenge.
Mm.
It made me wonder if he was actually out to kill her.
Mm.
But this kind of confirms that he was.
He's here to finish his work.
Yep. But my brain was spinning a little bit when he said that. Like, what's this actually mean? What's he planning on doing with her? Like, is he using her, or wants her to carry out something that he can't get close to, or something? I don't know.
Fair. We then, from Shanked, move into another one of our perspectives. This chapter is just filled with each of the perspectives and, you know, kind of a couple of points on each of them. But Friendly's perspective, he's really shocked strictly by the number of people that are around cheering in various capacities and can't count them all, as they are too numerous to him, it feels.
Yeah. He gets overwhelmed by crowds, of course. We've mentioned more explicitly that it's sort of a social anxiety that his counting helps with, and we've mentioned before with the battle, with the roiling sort of tide of people, that it became too overwhelming to count. So I'm curious, you can't count that many people, man. You just can't do it. But it is kind of funny to reflect on, like, why can't Friendly count this giant crowd of people?
yeah like, come on,
of course he can't.
It's also very funny because he counted all of the 1,000 swords, right? Like,
yeah,
he
but they all came
the near
through.
13,000.
Like,
right.
they were methodically coming through a single point at a
table.
Well,
he also, I think he had been counting them over the course of several days is more what I got, because they were still they still had so many people to pay out that he hadn't, that not everyone had been accounted for. So I think that he had been wandering through the camp and counting people, but nonetheless, I think that still points to kind of the same idea, right? Is that there was something controlled versus, like you said, the roiling tide, I think is a great example or a great way to put it. Crowds, you know, just not his thing.
Right.
Can't handle it. Man, we get a lot of interesting friendly here as well, because we jump into, we're still in his perspective, but his perspective specifically on Monza and Shivers is such like a great moment. Great is maybe the wrong thing, but it's a well-defined character moment as he sees clearly that Shivers wants her dead. So he thinks in his mind, but he's not very good at reading people, questions whether or not that could be the case, as he doesn't really understand either woman or fucking, and he knows that they're, you know, that they're doing that or love at all. And that we also get a reflection that like he can't keep it up himself during his exchanges with Sajam and the women that he would give him.
That, I mean, first of all, that's too bad. That's too bad, friendly. sorry to hear that. But
we know he gets hard counting things. And listening to Vittari count, right?
He mentions that
day counting. Sorry,
it helps when he was counting the thrusts a little bit. But the whole thing of it being like, it seeming rude to pass up a gift, which is how Shazam.
I'm just kidding. Yeah, Sajam.
Shazam. Why can I not say that right
Sajam?
Now?
Sajam. Sajam.
Sajam.
There you go.
That's how Sajam presented the prostitutes to him as a gift.
Mm-hmm.
God, yeah. that whole point fell on its face when I couldn't say his fucking name.
No. I think it's good. I liked my Shazam joke as well. So, so from friendly in that moment, we switch to Shivers, and there are a number of strong Shivers quotes within his little cut of perspective here. But he opens, and he's definitely spending a lot of time internally reflecting still, but it's almost as though there's like a shell of coldness to it. So Shivers reflects internally. Shivers was no monster. He just had enough of being treated like a fool, enough of his good intentions fucking him in the ass, enough of his minding his conscience, enough worrying on other people's worries, and most of all, enough of his face itching.
So I think it's important to jump back to friendly, making note of his time in safety taught him like when a face looked like it was the face of a man about to kill somebody, and he sees that face in Shivers, but backtracks a little bit on it, saying like he doesn't quite, like, this isn't safety, and maybe maybe things are different here. So to jump from that to be like, okay, no, Shivers is totally still thinking about killing her. It created a lot of tension and a lot of anticipation that doesn't really quite pay out. But my expectations were raised for a little bit of violence to come through.
I guess, you know, We'll maybe wrap up Shivers' perspective from this, and then I'll ask you this question. But yeah, it does build anticipation for something coming, I think. And it adds tension. It ratchets it up in a way that before he had been like contemplate, like way early on, like Sapani, who was like, I don't know, I could just stab her. And it's like, but I wouldn't do that. I love her. Like there's a lot of that. And, you know, even earlier on before they sleep with each other, around the time that they're messing around in Malthus or trying to kill Malthus, there's a lot of like, well, I could just leave and all of these other things. And now it's like his only path out is through.
Yeah.
In an obstacle is the way sense. So an additional note and reflection here that I appreciate from his internal monologue before it gets really dark. Monza was right. Mercy and cowardice were the same. There were no rewards for good behavior. Not in the north, not here, not anywhere. Life was an evil bastard and gave to those who took what they wanted. Right was the side of the most ruthless, the most treacherous, the most bloody, and the way all these fools cheered for her now was proof of it. And this is just such a good echo of the beginning, I think. in a lot of ways.
And I think this is the point that I was thinking on when talking about the morality of it all going more mm-hmm. in focus, because he says right is on the side of all these things, not favor and not power or anything like that. But it seems like morality is actually at the center of his focus here. Like, they are right to have, or they are right because of these attributions.
Yeah, it's unfortunate, but like, winning is the moral thing in so many different ways in life. Like, doing the right thing often isn't. And so infrequently are the people held accountable for their actions in which they win at any cost. Yeah. Right. And I think that's kind of what this is poking at.
It's poking at it, but it's straight up overlapping it. It's saying winning mm-hmm. is right.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess I'm just saying poking at it because I was thinking in almost a more grand context, right? Like, how often are like corrupt CEOs held seriously accountable for their actions? You know, like how many
Once
Ponzi schemes have we really taken down? Yeah, rare and few, you know, like plenty get through and like shouldn't continue to exist in some capacity. There's so many different things like that, like take advantage of people. But the only thing that matters is whatever that profit was, whatever that win was that they mm-hmm. fought for often, you know?
Yeah.
I don't know. We should be having a lot more Theranoses and people getting cold shakes than the other way around.
I figured that was the CEO you were talking about.
I mean, there are a couple, but yeah. Yeah. Woo! Okay. All right. So from there, woof, Shivers goes into some dark places as his thoughts are really horrifying as they kind of come to the fore of his mind. He gets into a much deeper and darker place than even he starts at here as he's talking through all of these different elements of monsters. In addition, as he contemplates them all, he's come to the other side on killing women as he thinks about murdering her because that was a huge problem for him back in Sapani when that happened. It was a monstrous confrontation for him as he like sat in the depths of despair, and now he can and doesn't fear it and doesn't think it cowardly like he once did. He pulls close upon the urging of Rogant a little bit after the fact up to her, but ultimately doesn't kill her while they're marching through the streets here, despite the potential chance, of course, doing the smart thing. But, you know, like you were saying earlier, this is where that intensity really builds.
Yeah, serious intensity, and yet another near miss on Monza's part. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Near assassination. And,
you know, Shivers quoting the Bloody Nine / Logan is never a good thing. But I mean, yeah. I love Bloody Nine quotes, don't get me wrong, but him pulling them out feels like,
well, he's done it before in good, like the you have to be realistic
mm-hmm.
context.
Mm-hmm. He's done a couple of them.
Yeah.
You know, that I think are in good context and in good faith. It's just love and hate has just a knife's edge between them.
Yeah.
Just feels like this sort of like sharper thing. And Shivers never thought of him as a good man. So reflecting on those things feels like a bad man coming to the fore in his perspective. Right. Versus like if it were Dogman or if it were Three Trees or someone else. But we're getting a lot of Black Down. We're getting a lot of Logan Nine Fingers.
Yeah. And this is coming off of the last time he mentioned Logan, he referred to him as a wise man. So like there's a shifting in perspective to him mm-hmm. that's coming through.
I do want to clarify, I definitely think that Logan is a wise man and a complicated character
for
and
sure.
a great character.
Shivers just has never thought that.
Yes, Shivers has never thought that about it, which is an important like distinction
right.
to draw. So we get a great description here, I think, between now and the very end of the novel as well, of preparation where we end the week, of the old Senate House in its grandiose Styrian fashion and production, and then a confrontation about the matter of her being named Grand Duchess as we flip back into Monza's perspective, especially with the previous one still alive. However, Rogant, apparently recently much more impatient, takes the circlet and appoints her right then and there, despite the attestations and the sort of the digressions from two members of the Senate here that are kind of pushing back and suggesting that she take a different title as opposed to one of a ruler explicitly. At the moment, she's forced to make a speech, and echoing Logan and Dogman's conversation from the very end of The Last Argument of the Kings, she's really not sure what's going to happen after the years of blood are over, and they can maybe, in almost verbatim, try to make things grow, maybe. But she promises, at the very least, to make things better.
Yeah, the whole speech of it, I mean, it's not a well-practiced... She's not a well-practiced orator by any means.
No.
But everything she's saying would and does resonate with the crowd and with the common people that have been tread upon through the years of blood.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of perfect, despite her stumbling through it. But yeah, I did appreciate the try to make things grow callback.
To the point of that, what's interesting to me here is that these are the least tread upon people. Like, these are the people of whom have benefited the most from the years of blood. This is Talons. They haven't been attacked, you know?
True,
like,
but
this is...
It's still living in wartime.
Yeah, oh, for sure, for sure. I'm just saying, like, of course they're cheering for an end to these things. They aren't the ones that are oppressed, and they see this from, like, a distant lens.
That's
but
true.
But also, this gets back to, like, Shank's thing and the fervor of the people for, like, something new and change, yeah. Right? Because Rogant had basically been delivering this promise anyway. Orso had been delivering this promise anyway. So, like, their cheering is just for a different face. It speaks to the effect of the propaganda, really. Vengeance in big capital letters scrawled on a wall. Of course, after jumping between each of these different perspectives, we're left with just one that we haven't visited yet. That of Morvir. And he's trying to blow dart gun our girl in such a crazy fucking moment. He shoots wide on the first one, cursing his damnable past again for failing in his present, as though it was Day's fault somehow that this didn't happen. And he attempts again and just, like, shoots randomly into the crowd as it's, like, blown away because she moves a little bit. Like, Jesus, man.
I do love that. It's her ceremonial armor that she's complaining about from the beginning, and he damns it right away, forcing him to aim for her face, which is the only thing that's visible. And he misses by a relatively small margin. So, ironically, that armor actually did save her completely, because I think if he had a chance to just aim for, like, the center of her chest or something, he would have hit her.
Very true. Very true. There's another subtle thing that I totally skipped here in that armor, so I'm glad that you brought it up. It's funny as a note that it seems as though Joe is kind of condemning the, like, fantasy trend of, like, big-breasted women in, like, armors and battle bras like we had talked about previously. And it's like, well, no, we need to, like, build it out more so that it appears that you're that way. And she's like, whatever.
This is what the people want to see.
Fucking Rogant. Yeah. Yeah. Just an interesting, like, little side note on top of the rest of that. And it's like, you're commenting. This is as close to the hand of the author as I can see, but you are very clearly commenting on that.
Right.
Which is a funny, nice little note. Yeah. Yeah. And just fucking, dude. Master Poisoner, my ass. Just fucking, he doesn't even care that it, like, blew wide and shot someone in the crowd.
Why would he care?
I don't know.
At this,
like,
point, what about him
just
would say
murdering
that he would care
about
that?
I know. But, like, come on. There's no contemplation at all. Like, every one of our other characters, more or less, at some point in this novel, has felt some form of guilt around killing someone. Morvir, not an ounce of guilt,
except
for
maybe
his killing Day. Yeah. But that's because of a personal attachment, not because of, you know, yeah. Oh, man. Another man is kind of, like, turning and bumps into him to accost him, and he poisons him almost immediately with, like, a flick.
Speaking of indiscriminate killing.
He's just like, it's so funny. I guess he wins a little bit of my faith back for the swift actions. And I do really like the kind of quote here that he has as he kind of says things, because there is definitely something to this in terms of social engineering, right? Morvir reclaimed the pipe and slid it into one of his myriad of concealed pockets along with the needle. It takes the vast majority of men a great deal of time to become truly incensed, usually following a predictable ritual of escalating threats, insults, posturing, jostling, and so forth. Instantaneous action is entirely foreign to them.
Yeah, which I think is then followed up with this, like, slowly dying man, or fairly quickly dying man, starting to get angry about it.
Right. Just enough time for it to set in.
Yeah, for a second, though, I thought he was going to be pinning the poisoning on this guy by giving him the pipe. Like, I thought he was going to give him the blow dart and, like, fuck off. Because he didn't just, like, act like somebody's going to notice that there was a poison dart near
in a random person.
Yeah.
And then also one near the pillar. Yeah.
Yeah. So, like, that's going to tip somebody off soon. But really did just get the cartoon thing of, like, handing the guy a weapon, doing something else to him, and, like, taking it back and leaving.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. There's a lot of good humor in it. Morvir sucks, but there's a lot of good humor in Morvir.
Yeah.
So Morvir continues down in a way to, you know, escape from his locale in which he was trying to assassinate Monza. And he weekend at Bernie's, this guy, the large man that he poisoned, convincing a crowd that he's fine, as though he just had too much to drink and whatever. And he even uses, like, totally too big of words for the crowd at the time. And they go, what? And he's like, not in talks of what? And yeah, explains he's drunk. Before he goes on an internal rant about Monza, calling her all sorts of crazy things, before settling on the grandest of incel insults to end this chapter, he was forced to reflect once again, as he had so often, that life was rendered immeasurably easier for the comely. Jesus Christ. Yeah.
A couple comments on that. One, by his own assertions, we can take these to be Joe's actual real life opinions, right?
Right. Yeah, absolutely.
For sure.
But all I think of Morvir.
I think this is important to note on, like, beyond just the phrasing of it and everything, like, gross, whatever. But we get the back and forth yet again between Monza reflecting on her scars and her, like she's deformed beyond what she is no longer the person. She no longer looks like how she used to look. And we get Morvir on the flip side talking about, oh, she's gotten this far because of how beautiful she is.
Yeah.
Which has happened only before, specifically between Monza and Morvir, I think.
Right.
Yeah.
He's brought it up at the very least internally and maybe externally today at least once.
Yeah.
And just the way that he cuts her down in so many different ways, you know, a ruthless, scheming, lying, apprentice seducing, mass murdering, noisily fornicating peasant thief without a filigree shred of conscience, whose only qualifications for commands were a sulky manner, a few victories against incompetent opposition, the aforementioned propensity to swift action, a fall down a mountain, and the accident of a highly attractive face. Like, okay, dude, go off.
Oh,
yeah.
Morvir.
More fucking Vir. We're gonna have a lot more to say about Morvir at the very end here. But with that, we'll go into our mid-episode break, our little drink segment. PJ, what did you have this morning?
Coffee. Just
coffee?
Made myself
what type
some
of coffee?
Coffee. I don't remember single origin counterculture. Mm-hmm. French pressed, but I don't remember what coffee specifically it was.
To be fair, I don't either. And yeah. I generally, like, keep my little labels, but this week, for whatever reason, when I replaced mine, I threw it away.
That's all I do.
Generally, I cut it out and then I put it next to my coffee grinder, my bean grinder, so I know what I'm drinking. But
you and I have the same bean grinder, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah,
you told me to buy.
Did you get the OXO?
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. So yeah. I just open it up and pour it in there and then throw the bag away.
Yeah, I occasionally catch myself doing that, but I try as often as I can remember to cut that little, like, square out and then keep it there. I almost want to get, like, a little stand so that I can, like, have it there nicely as opposed to just kind of leaning up against my coffee maker, or maybe like a little wall hanger right next to it because it's right next to a little
You should
wall.
Frame.
Got like
each
a little
one.
Coffee nook. No, I won't do that. They only last a week. It's a lot of effort as is to cut out that little extra out of the bag for no reason. Mm-hmm. But mostly just to try to remember what I'm drinking.
You could laminate it.
They're already practically laminated.
Set it as your phone background.
No. I love coffee as much as the next person, but I would not do that. We're both having Counterculture Single Origin. Mine is of a brighter varietal. Again, Single Origin just generally is. But in particular, mine, I believe, is the... It was the release from October that we got, which I think was like blood orange. It's a very like brown, rich, but light flavor. So like warming spices, very fall.
Gotcha.
With like that deeper blood orange citrus. So like not sharp like lime or lemon would be.
Cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you have a big backlog of them?
Yeah, because I was gone in Texas and I forgot to turn the stuff off. I was traveling for so long. And I get 2 bags a week, or 2 bags every 2 weeks. So I don't always go through a full bag in a week because some days I'll skip coffee if I'm like not feeling it on like a weekend in particular. So I kind of get like a bag backlog roughly every month. I currently have 7 bags. So I have turned off my subscription while also unemployed for, you know, foreseeably a couple of weeks because I have so much fucking coffee to drink from.
Makes sense.
When I've been traveling. So
each bag lasts like 5 days for me.
That's fair. Well, cause two of you are drinking it too, right?
Yeah. We make it for two. So I'm on, I just finished this bag. I've got one more, but I've got the delivery coming up soon. So
cool. Yeah. 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 This, not to belabor the point, but this most recent delivery looked really good and I think had one of the returning Single Origin dried favorites that I really like that they did. You know, it's got like the weird like blue and yellow striped label versus like the classic, more classic label. So those are the purely dried versus roasted, which really good dried coffee is just stellar for flavor. But
I think that's the one I've got.
All coffee is generally dried and then roasted, but not everything is then roasted after dried. So cool.
Right.
Alrighty. From there, we'll head into the Lion's Skin, which is a little bit different than the Lion's Den, which is sort of what this is to some degree, which is just an interesting kind of outset, you know, as a comparison point. Obviously, it has more to do with the saying that's revealed inside of the chapter, but as a title, it's interesting.
Mm-hmm. It is. It is interesting. Didn't know what to think of it when I first came across it, but obviously made sense.
Yeah. I don't know that I thought anything of it either, you know, as reading through it in either read until now, having to analyze it a little bit more and closely, or choosing to. So from where we left Monza and everyone else, we head to Fontezarmo, and considering all that's changed since we were last here, I can see why she'd reflect on it so differently now that a year has passed since she was last beneath its cliffs, so much having changed in these 4 seasons as the Thousand Swords continues to lay their siege to the city castle on top of the hill. It's not really a city. It's a castle. But
yeah, it's a
kind of a city.
I assumed it was just the castle named Fontezarmo, but I guess it is kind of a its own sort of self-contained city thing.
Yeah, a little bit. Like, you know.
Regardless, this siege felt different than any of the others that we've experienced throughout this story. And I think namely because it's all going on in the background. And we don't really get a ton of specifics about it until we get the tactics that they're using to weed out the brave men.
The stupid brave men. Yeah.
Yeah. But it's been commented on that sieges aren't that exciting in the past. And here they're just like, the action's over there. We're not going to really dwell on it at all.
Right. Yeah, it is interesting. I do want to bring up, I think that this is the first and only time that we've been on the attacking side of a siege.
Yeah, I think.
Yeah.
I think that is accurate.
The only other time that it even got close was the moment in which we settled a siege before it really began with Fenris the Feared. You know, like that was bound to be an attacking siege.
That's a good point.
But and that
the,
wasn't.
the posturing for a siege is almost as important as starting an actual siege when it comes to...
Which is like, sort of what Koska is saying here too.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah. There's something funny too about obviously Monza running into her old lieutenants and whatnot, but the way that she calls Victus greedy as a duck, brave as a pigeon, loyal as a cuckoo just got me. I don't know why. Last night when I was doing notes, I was just like, this is so good.
I've never heard also, a phrase like birds. That before. Of course all they're all birds. All birds. Yeah. I have never considered the loyalty of a cuckoo before. Do you think they're particularly unloyal?
Yeah. Because they're traitors, they're bastards. They lay their eggs in other birds' nests and then they kick the eggs out.
Yeah.
Like, yeah.
I forgot about that part.
Yeah. Yeah. They're assholes. They also sing all those weird tones because like they have a variety of like mating calls to like attract other birds. So they're fucking weird, man. Cuckoos are nasty.
Cuckoos are cuckoo.
Mm-hmm. For Cocoa Puffs. one of my favorite books that I read this year is also titled The Cuckoo, which is why it's kind of front and center in my mind, all of these different things as it relates to cuckoos. But yeah, crazy.
Mm-hmm.
Crazy little fucking birds. Invictus, just the fucking douche.
Terrible bird.
Yeah, terrible bird, man. So she continues to have a conversation with him, of course, separating from the guards that had been following her that were appointed by Rogant. And it appears as though Koska may have met with Orso, as Victus mentions, at least once before the siege. The whole thing is well fortified and certainly going to take some work to break in, as it were, as we kind of find out over the course of the chapter as well.
I am so intrigued by the meeting of Koska and Orso. I wanted to say Orso there.
Orso. But, Orzo. Yeah.
I know Koska can talk his way into basically anywhere. We've seen him do it. But even for him, this meeting feels far-fetched.
Yeah.
And is suspicious to me in some way.
Yeah. It is definitely suspicious. And we know Koska's... I mean, I think Monza says as much that like Koska is a consummate betrayer, you know, whoever's going to pay him to do the most on either side. And he's done that multiple times. So at the very least, there are other troops here to ensure that, you know, it isn't just the Thousand Swords. There's the Aphoians and a number of other members, the Osprians, etc., that are here as well.
The Baelish.
I don't think the fuck off. The Baelish were sent home where they belong.
Back into obscurity with you.
Yeah, yeah. And all the while there's this kind of conversation going and she's being brought to Koska basically to have a conversation or at the very least to attend to wait for Koska, there is more talk of the siege. And there's this moment where she just absolutely shits on Victus for like all of the different tactics that are going on as like he points up to the tower that's on fire. He's like, we blew that up with a cab pole. And she's like, you fucking cool, dude.
I loved your mocking rendition of how he said that.
Yeah, I mean, it's just so she demeans it as almost like a childish thing,
right?
As though it provided some sort of sense of competence and to an incompetent man, as she kind of like feels about Victus.
Yeah, I just going back to the bird comment because it's still about Victus. Brave as a pigeon as an insult is really funny going into this conversation where bravery is seen as a negative trait.
It's interesting because the whole thing is that the Thousand Swords are bred basically to remove the brave from their lines,
right?
Yeah, so like, of course, unbrave captains would exist, and more reserved, you know, like generals would make it to the top for that very reason. It's interesting. Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. The Thousand Swords are just a bunch of cowards, but there are so many of them that they can't be stopped.
there are so many of them, and they're good salesmen.
Mm-hmm. Very good salesmen. There's another thing where he rehearses or recites a quote that we've heard a couple of different times, and he says Stalicus said
Stalicus
between the quote. Stalicus got me, and she just goes, Stalicus, you fucking dolt, or whatever. Like, it's another just great shitting on Victus insult, which is cool because we don't get like any of these like other commanders, you know, for the most part. I mean, we get a little bit of Andished the most before, but we don't really like know anything about these other commanders. So he's characterized so well in so little time.
Right. As a sniveling, depressing specimen.
So after a parting spit on Victus for his small part in all of this, Shivers steps in to ensure that he backs off. She's left alone with Shivers for a brief moments, and it seems like she wants to say something to him before he interrupts, and then he is interrupted by Koska's entrance. So there's like this kind of threefold tier interruption as it goes.
Interruption. That was good. But as far as her spitting in Victus's face and mentioning that, like, he just has spit on his face instead of holding in his guts, I wonder if that would still have been the case if she hadn't been put off by her quest for vengeance so much so far. Would she be more ruthless had she not gone through what she has? Has she gone soft? I guess is kind of what I'm asking, or kind of what I'm thinking
about. I don't
know,
but I think that it goes to show that like killing someone isn't the revenge that she sought, and maybe this is enough. Then again, like the amount that Victus wronged her is pretty low on the totem pole of things, you know. Like, but it just goes to show that vengeance is like a petty thing more than anything else, I think, and that like pettiness could have won the day instead. Obviously, it went. Like, what is a petty victory against people who literally tried to murder you is a different question entirely. But, you know.
Yeah, that's true. But I am so ready for more actual conversation between Monza and Shivers. Or an actual confrontation, or whatever it ends up being.
But it's building that tension, like we were saying earlier. Like, it's ratcheting up. Perhaps there was a reason that I cut off where we did. But it was the holidays.
I think it was just you just flipped to a page and decided here's where we're ending.
That is exactly how I do it every time. That's how we arbitrarily accidentally get weird stopping points sometimes. clearly. Yeah, there's just so much here that's so great to kind of dig into. But there's something else about the appointment that Koska kind of calls out as he had entered. He speaks about selling the lion skin before it's killed. That's such an excellent turn of phrase that I'd never heard before. But also, I've, you know, obviously counting your eggs before they hatch and like other things like that, you know, kind of fall in. But the lion skin in particular caught me as like a whole different sort of rendering of that idea, as though you had a mission to accomplish first before something else could happen. But they continue, and it does seem like the relationship between Monza and Rogant may be souring, despite it's also strengthening as his power solidifies, including that of a delivery of 1,000 songbirds from Thond.
Only 1,000?
White songbirds, yeah.
Was Thond one of the previously mentioned countries or areas? Like, I feel like I recognize it, and I'm pretty sure maybe it was in the double sixes thing.
Yeah, I don't remember if it was doubles. Yes, it was. It wasn't double sixes. I believe that it came up. But yeah, Thond has been mentioned a couple of times over the course of the whole series. Not often, you know, it's not often remarked upon, but it is indeed another island. I think I also maybe further planted it in your brain when I think we cut this out of the episode, but when I went on a rant of where I don't know where the fuck Bale is.
I don't know if we cut it out of the episode.
The Sea of Baelish. Oh, maybe we didn't. The Sea of Baelish is between Thond and Styria.
Gotcha.
And so it was just, I was like, where the fuck is Bale? And that was my whole problem. But yeah. So Thond has been remarked upon a couple of times. It shows on several of the maps later. But and I think I also made mention of that we will eventually do a little expedition to Thond in Sharper Ends, which is why I said that I knew Thond was real and brought up. So
gotcha.
Not a main series entry, but Sharper Ends.
Right next to the story about Sharper Bale. Ends.
Right. Yeah, for sure. That one. Not at all mentioned in this book a bunch of times that I should have thought about at all.
So funny. And what's really funny is that episode, I think, that we've been goofing on the whole time just came out yesterday.
Mm-hmm. Did it?
Or Saturday, or on Friday, I think. So shit. We haven't even gotten to the point where you're getting corrective emails about it.
Oh, fuck. Oh, no. Oh, no. Yeah. I don't know. So that's how that goes. But any other notes on the wine skin comment?
No, I mean, the only other like real world turn of phrase that I could think of was counting your eggs before they hatch. I'm sure there are numerous edits to that to fit different scenarios, but I'm curious, or I appreciated how fitting this one was. It still got the same thing across, but it's dealing with an apex predator.
Right.
Instead of and, just and some fucking fresh, birds.
How fresh that twist on it feels, right? You know? Also, we're dealing with a bunch of birds throughout this whole thing. So it's funny to have like a cat comment after all the birds. Also, I think it points to, we've talked before about the animals that are associated with each of these people. I think it points to Orso being a lion, perhaps, and perhaps pride?
We just took some time. We wrote out all the seven deadly sins, all of the recipients of Monza's vengeance, and played a little matching game. I once played in 10th grade government class or whatever with the states and capitals.
So maybe we go every other, and I'll let you kick it off with this, and we can kind of walk through what they are and why we think they are.
We have let's save the top one for the end.
Yep, sure. So let's go the other way.
For envy, we put faithful Carpi.
Mm-hmm.
For gluttony,
and that's hang on. Envy for Carpi is because he took the position of Monza and was like complicit in the idea and ended up just kind of securing it. Of the reasons, I feel like his is maybe the most loose outside of Gaba's.
Yeah. So Gaba's we put as gluttony, which it mentions him kind of amassing some wealth around town or some, he's kind of a,
some wealth and secrets, and he's just kind of slimy and like accruing. Yeah.
So that's one we went back and forth on. We had him in a couple different spots, but
mm-hmm.
I he's think because like of everyone else, he fits the best here.
True. Yeah.
Pride we put with Ganmark, which I think he presents himself pretty astutely as a proud man.
Yeah. I mean, in a couple of different ways, right? Like proud of his like place in preserving history and art. And then in addition, being unwilling to put down Monza like a dog, instead encouraging a duel, which is a prideful thing that ultimately leads to his downfall. Correct. So I think that both of those things kind of point pretty directly to pride for Ganmark.
Lust, we put with Ario, died in a pleasure house.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's...
Yeah, taking multiple lovers, just known as a party guy, you know? I mean...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Greed... We put Malthus, and I think that's more of a commentary on his working with money all the time than any sort of personal faults or any personality traits. Like
his stake in the vengeance is a greedy one because it ensures his survival in his position, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Like, that's my stake in a lot of these is how does it relate to the moment as like the death occurs, right? Too. So maybe I should have highlighted those more. But
Sloth, we put with Foscar, who was kind of a circumstance of inaction more than anything.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And to the point of just pointing out how they were in the moment of the murder, Ganmark is like doing the right thing according to the orders that he's given, you know, and so that's like a prideful thing. And he takes pride in being the executor of Orso's will. And that's something that is like a big core argument that happens right away between him and Benna as well. And then obviously, to kind of cap it all off, we have Wrath with Orso. And this whole thing, every moment that we have with Orso is pretty much wrathful. I mean, he is angry and getting angrier. He is seeking cruelty beyond vengeance, because if he really wanted to just kill her, he would have just killed her, as opposed to throwing her off the balcony.
Yeah, I think that works.
Cruelty in what he chose to do.
And to do her brother in first too. And make her watch that.
Yeah. Cool. All right. We've been dancing around this for such a long time. It was good to like work it out. Plus, yeah, if there's an episode where we have the time to do it, it's this one.
That's true.
So moving back into the chapter, now that we've gone through that line scan and kind of thinking through all of those things, we catch up with Friendly on the idea of the fight as it goes, as people appear to be almost suicidally climbing the walls, as he clearly paints it to be an impossible task as he speaks of Sazine's method, he, of course, being Koska. All the while, though, Ishri appears again and explains that they secretly are digging a hole to fill with Gurkish sugar, or Gurkish fire, as a sort of sweeter take on the name, but it's going to take some 21 odd days. Which is going to turn into one hell of a siege.
Yeah. The method, just to lay it out, to remind everybody, they have a bounty for the first men to make it up the wall, basically.
Mm-hmm.
To take the wall. And you either do the impossible for a mere 2,000 scales, because it's 1,000 to the first and 100 to the first 10 afterwards.
The next 10. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So you either do the impossible for 2,000 scales, or you cull all the brave men who are opposed to cause problems in the future.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a genius move, and it does get into sort of this idea that like Shivers finds super baffling.
Yeah.
And yeah,
I liked that Shivers was incensed by this idea, or just found it incredulous. He it proves that he hasn't completely assimilated into sort of Mons's original line of thinking. Like we've talked about them sort of switching positions a little bit, but there's still some stark differences between how war is made here within the Thousand Swords, which is not necessarily indicative of Styria as a whole, but where he finds himself, this group of people, and what he's used to in the North.
I do think, you know, Sazine, of course, being the old Captain General before the retired or was retired, is interesting. But then in additionally, there's the reflection that Monza brings in right afterwards, right? Which is bravery is the dead man's virtue. The wise commander never trusts it. And then Koska goes, ah, Verturio, he knows how to make death funny. And it's just this sort of disassociation almost with the philosophy of it all.
Yeah. And it felt like he was excited to slip back into some philosophy lessons between him and Monza, mm-hmm. just even if yeah. for a small moment.
Yeah. Worrying to the herd, dangerous to bystanders. There's a small note here as Ishri kind of creepily shows up and she's like, well, I do what I want. It's more fun that way.
She
it's Monza's like, can you walk in normally?
Into view too.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like she knows how to make an entrance using the Kirkish sugar.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and she just is laying on the couch, propped up with one hand, you know, one leg over, bandages, you know, vaguely in the wind. It's a very cool little entrance here by many regards. But she says that she isn't going to be able to stick around, as her brother was killed by a woman seeking vengeance in the south.
Was it in the south that she mentioned that specifically?
In the south.
Okay. Yeah. This feels very much like a nod to Pharaoh. I'm not positive that. I feel like I'm missing something. Like I'm missing some connection that's been made. But
I don't know.
I don't know if I am.
I think that's what it's saying. I think that's exactly what it's saying.
Mm-hmm.
Who do we know that kills eaters? and like has a particular vengeance and is a woman tearing through the South. You know, like it's a very specific
There's a small cross section of people that this could apply to.
Yeah. It's mostly Pharaoh.
it's entirely Pharaoh.
I think it's entirely Pharaoh. Yeah. So yeah, it's interesting to get this little flash in what's going on with her, and that also being enough to pull the eater away from what is effectively, because it seems in hand, you know, that the country will be under Gurkish proxy control, if not actually conquered.
Yeah, I guess I wasn't saying that there was something I was missing. Like it could be somebody other than Pharaoh. I'm wondering if there was anything pointing to this being something we've already seen on page. Like if this was part of the scene.
We're years in the future at this point. So
yeah.
Good point. I think that this is laid out to say that another one of the winds died, or maybe perhaps, you know, a couple of the 100 words that were left over, because we know they weren't all killed. They were just mostly killed. Mm. You know, there might be some of those.
Yeah.
Yeah. We kind of round out this conversation with Acosta taking another sip from his flask and having a confrontation between, you know, Monza and otherwise, saying, maybe you should try sticking to one side or the other. And he replies, why would anyone do that? It's a war. There's no right side. And it's a repudiation of that intro.
Yeah. It's also how he's always conducted himself, you know, and it's worked for him pretty well. But you're right. Like the change ban sort of thesis that he was setting forward.
I don't even mean the change ban thing. Which part are you talking about from the beginning?
I'm
talking about specifically when he's talking about the morality of everything. And then in addition, as he reflects, it's reinforcing his moral position. There is no right side in conflict and in war, which is kind of what he's arguing in the very beginning. And then Shivers is kind of having a different conversation in his head. But then in addition, it's a repudiation of Monza's reflection in the flashback, in which, you know, depending on the side of the river, you know, is whether or not you're being cheered for or not. Maybe it's not a repudiation.
I think that's too strong, at the very least. I don't think it is. I think she would agree with that. Because the idea of who's right and who's wrong is just dependent on location and just dependent on who's looking at it. So,
and Costco is just arguing that it doesn't matter who's looking on it. There is no good.
Yeah. Fair.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Yeah. It's interesting. And I think it speaks to like his real status as a mercenary versus her like flirting with it, because she kind of thinks that she's doing the right thing.
Yeah. And she's also
has always thought that
effectively, I think technically, officially, no longer a mercenary.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's in her blood, you could argue, but yeah, I would agree.
Yeah. I mean, by profession,
she has a stake.
She still is, but she is the leader of part of the country.
Talents. Yeah.
A Duchess of Talents, leader, as it were.
But
yeah, she has some official capacity that she's working within.
Right. Cool. Anything else on our champions of the week?
Champion is I stand on the other side of the river from you, Crossland.
Perfect. So you stand on Morvir's side of the river.
Absolutely.
So we go into preparation. We're back with Morvir making his own preparations for what is to come, and also having egregiously failed a dozen some odd times trying to poison the various people that he's been hired to poison for his million scales. And somewhat, he notes a couple of times, could have led to of avoiding killing them with a proper assistant and maybe education, or like being a little bit more cautious. In the end, I think he just really misses Day.
Day. It's kind of sad.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Poor guy.
Kills a cat.
On accident.
It's so funny. It's so funny. All of this.
It's like the blow dart into the crowd, but like more ridiculous. Like the dress and it being like the wrong size, obviously, for the woman. And like if you would have thought, you know, it again shows how little he thinks of women, period. But like there's just so many different complex kind of things going on from his perspective as he continues to fail and fail and fail.
Yeah, I want a montage whether or not he's of the failures.
Yeah.
In the video or in the movie.
Again, so good. Will be so funny. There is a funny note that he does manage to poison one person, Sartorius, the Duke of Sapani, of whom fails, but that old fucker just wouldn't die. And Morvir's only assumption is that he has a lot of experience with poisons and that he inures himself in some odd way.
Yeah. Have we dealt with Sartorius much?
Yeah. He's been in the story a couple of different times. First, okay. he was the Duke of Sapani that was considered... Super true. He was the Duke of Sapani that was considered the neutral territory, right? Mm-hmm. So he was the guy, he was the older man of whom Casca had dealings with and other people, but was ultimately trying to bring the Union and Styria together, the League meeting. His was considered the neutral ground. Then he just recently joined the League of Eight to become the League of Nine last week. So he's that guy, basically. Right. The old fuck of whom won't die. And
invulnerable
clearly won't
to poison.
Die. Right. And he got poisoned with the same shit that killed Day. So, like, we know it works. We, like...
Yeah. We do know crazy. That. Day was not... Day did not practice what she preached with caution first, always.
Well, she chugged a whole bottle of the stuff versus... Like, this is just a little fleck on his ear. You know, like a little, like, hand grazing or something that he thought would be enough. So... Morvir resolves that his next move must be to focus on the highest tier of targets from his list of people to kill. Because when I failed to assassinate the lower targets in Assassin's Creed, I definitely moved to the big bad boss guy. That's the right move.
Hey, we kind of talked about this with Monza, though. Like, things would have been a lot easier if she'd gone for Duke Orso first.
True. This is kind of an assumptive flip, so good point. But that of Monza and Duke Rogant, of course, are the targets. As such, buildings are being fitted for the coming of the king, and he dresses as a handyman, and him patting himself on the back for jointing on the balustrade is just so funny to me, as he reflects and he says, like, truly, he was lost to carpentry.
I laughed so hard at this, but yeah. I'm curious if it's actually a good job. Or
I don't fucking think so, dude.
I think he's just got such an inflated ego of himself that he's like patting himself on the back, like brushing his pants off, walking away at the. And you look at this shoddy piece of shit patchwork garbage that he's put together. But he doesn't tip anybody off that he's not actually an apprentice carpenter or whatever he's he killed a
pretending
guy for
to
it.
Be.
He killed a guy for his credentials.
His clothes.
Yeah, exactly.
Some poor sod.
Some guy who came from overseas for looking for work so he wouldn't be missed by anybody.
Which is basically Shivers, you know? Like,
yeah.
Could have been just randomly killed.
Mm-hmm.
Fuck Styria.
But it does point to Morvir at least being competent in what he's doing to a certain degree. Like, he does the vetting and... pulls this off, so like he's not totally incompetent. It's just whether or not he's actually a master.
Yeah, right.
As far as the setting of this goes, where he's setting up this, he's part of the crew setting up the Senate House. It made me think very strongly of another series. I'm going to try to avoid some spoilers, where there's a large meeting that is, they pick the Colosseum in Rome as the setting. If you've read the series, you know what I'm talking about exactly, but I'll leave it at that. Feels similar.
I'd bring up a slightly different series as well in context and say that there is a similar setting specifically in the Well of Ascension that is brought to the fore. As well from certain characters, but and it reminds me of that as well, as it's like dressed up and dolled up and repaired and stuff like that. So, yeah.
All for vanity.
Yeah, yeah, vanity and presentation, one way or another. Oh man, what a truly a loss to carpentry, and not like the guy that he killed wasn't a loss to carpentry. Jesus Christ, you egomaniac. Anyway, Morvir bears some well-earned frustration as well, perhaps not actually, that Rogant would be crowned here in the heart of the old empire, the new empire, the new old empire. It's unclear. The terms keep flipping around. I think it's the new empire, but it's clearly an old thing as it was declared. But he slips around the building, getting its bearing, passing statues of the soon-to-be king, flags, and more before he makes it to a door. He kind of sneaks into the room and two laborers kind of follow him in. He hides behind a couple of different things and they have a conversation about keeping the key in the lock here. And it's a fancy, fancy box that Morvir finds himself.
Yeah. First of all, the door itself, this big, heavy oak door that he wasn't there before. And this throws off or would have thrown off his entire plan. But he decides today only, what does he say? Instead of caution first, it's, but audacity?
Audacious. Yeah. Yeah. Yep. Audacious.
So, you know, he's flipping the script a little bit. Maybe it'll pay off for him. The lock, the key in the lock is hilarious too. Like, just speaking on security in general and as more and more people become involved in a plan, it becomes more and more difficult to truly secure something. Mm-hmm. And like, they're like, no, I don't want to be fumbling around with a key when we have to like go get this thing. Like, just leave the key right there. It'll be right there. We'll know where it is. Then we like, it's why have a lock deal at all?
Right. Well, and it's very like officious. That's the entire presentation here, right? Like, this is meant to be something that is like ceremonial. My question for you is like, what's in the box? In a very Seven way.
What's in the box? Talking about the
Seven Deadly Sins. What's in the box?
Yeah. I assumed the crown, right?
Sure. It just says gold shining.
Yeah, I assumed the crown. Sure. But I'd forgotten that it didn't explicitly say that.
Yeah. No. It doesn't, but it seems like it. It seems the most likely thing. I mean, yep. Pretty
well,
clearly declares
this. Well,
think
about that
like
all
important
fucking time, Crossland.
PJ, that's what I'm trying to make you do. But now you're going to be able to read the next section in like T-minus 5 minutes. So as though you're not going to.
Yeah.
I mean, you might not do that immediately, but soon.
I probably will.
Yeah, that's fair. You got a couple of hours. But yeah. So he then gets to the act itself, though, with the item inside of this box, donning his feminine calfskin gloves and his other utilities from the bottom of his pop-out of his workman's thing that's the secret compartment within the box itself, some crazy spy-level bullshit. And he paints on a layer of preparation number 12, seemingly like maybe the real King of Poisons to some degree. Like, it sounds like this is something that he designed himself. It's a contact poison, one that cannot be inured against in any fashion. You know?
Yeah. Preparation number 12 also is a much more ominous name than King of Poisons.
Right.
But I don't know about you, Crossland, but I was jealous of this pair of gloves. Like, they sounded so comfortable. I've never really had a nice pair of gloves that I can like really work with because my hands are too big. So like they don't go all the way to the bottom of my fingers most of the time. It'd be nice to have like a nice, like really dexterous pair of leather gloves.
Dexterous. Yeah, that would be a problem. I've got weird hands as well, PJ. So there are certainly gloves that are much more likely to fit me than you, but every pair that I buy always, of leather gloves specifically, always just don't reach quite long enough. I've got weirdly long fingers for the size of my hands, but you know, I don't know. I can't palm a basketball like you can. So it's a very different problem.
Maybe you and I need to
go into the glove business
and make some gloves for ourselves.
Very different, different modes. He's just like, let's kill a cow. I'm like, let's start a business, I guess.
Oh,
certainly a take. You know, my parents do raise cattle. I wonder if we could get cowhide. Be a fun little project.
That
I have nothing else to do.
Project.
But yeah,
that's one that has a name on it. We want this to be
perfect,
as horrifying as possible.
What a good end to this week. Yeah. Yeah. So cool. Well, that's PJ. That's it. We're left with him preparing preparing the poison and applying it to this golden object of which we assume is a crown inside of the box.
Yeah.
So how does this go now?
What else could it be? It could be like a goblet, I guess.
Could be a scepter. Yeah.
Yeah. Something ceremonial. Yeah.
Yeah. I feel like those are the reasonable assumptions.
Earrings?
For Rogant?
Nipple rings. Ooh, just the golden cock cage. He seems like somebody need something
all
like
right.
that.
So, so cool. So sweet. Sick, sick, sick. I'm so glad that we are reading this book. Just a golden cock cage. Jesus Christ. As though that would come out during... at all, ever, actually. Don't even need to entertain that idea. Okay. All right. So, with that, PJ, we are brought to the end of this week. Is there anything that you're thinking about going into next week? Again, we've got two episodes left of the show to record for the end of this book here. Where's your brain go?
I think we're going to end the next section with the completion of, or with the explosion of the walls with the Gurkha sugar. Mm. But I think that'll be the cliffhanger you leave me on.
Sure.
I assume we'll get the crowning of Rogant ahead of that.
Sure.
I think so. Because okay. He's impatient like that. 3 weeks is a long time to wait.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like there's been a little bit of time passing here too, in Morvir's perspective, because they fixed up this dome so much.
Yeah,
from where
and
the
he's been
the week.
He's been so, honing his carpentry
yeah,
skills.
Statues. Yeah. Right. And he's failed to assassinate a bunch of people.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cool. What about Shanked? What about, so that's like Morvir, that's Rogant. I think he's really the only one left out of that picture he painted.
Shanked kills Monza.
Yeah.
He does it.
Do you think that happens? Then you think that happens in 2 weeks, not next week, probably.
No, I think right? that happens like next chapter.
Oh, cool. Yeah. All right. Sometimes I just must roll with it.
I don't know with Shanked. Don't know what to make. I want to get some more backstory on what his revenge is and how Monza is involved.
Cool. Well, okay. Mm-hmm. Sweet.
Sweet.
Well, with that, we'll talk about next week here real quick. Next week, we are going to be reading, continuing obviously in part 7, Talon's Rules Through the Inevitable. It's like 4 chapters again, but they're longer chapters to some degree, breaking up kind of the very ending here. So we are right there, PJ. We're right there.
Right fucking there.
Right fucking there.
If you would like to hear more from us, you can reach out to us on social media at Words Whiskey Pod. You can mm-hmm. give us a call, give us a text. Do not fax us. Our fax machine is down at 910-408-2534. Only calls and texts, no faxes. I'm tired of hearing the clunking and error messages from my fax machine.
Chunk, chunk. Yeah.
It tries, but all the messages get jumbled. So 910-408-2534.
Yeah. Follow us on all those social medias, like PJ had mentioned. Check us out, patreon.com/wordsandwhiskey, if you want to support what we do here, of course. That's a big deal. Beyond that, if you want to support us in other ways, you can leave us a review. Reviews go a long way to sharing the show naturally in algorithms and other things like that. So definitely do that if you wouldn't mind. If you don't leave a 5-star review, I will fail to poison you a couple of times, but then I'll settle on a more audacious plan. And, you know, your pets will die, and then other people around you might randomly die, but I'll get you eventually.
That's almost worse than just dying.
I think so. It'll be like the neighborhood cat will die, not your cat. Yeah. You'll just suddenly stop noticing it. You'll be like, oh, what happened? Like, it was me! All right, we'll see you next week.
Bye.